Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Atlantic Magazine program, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer reader. I'll be reading articles from the online edition of the Atlantic, all of them dated December of 2024. I hope you enjoy the program. I'll begin with this article titled, What If You Just Skip the Holidays? You can be a good family member without following traditions. It's written by Faith Hill. For years ahead of family holiday gatherings, Alicia Dudley would wake up anxious. Since she'd gotten married, her relatives and her husband's had wanted them at multiple different celebrations for each occasion. Bundling up her small child and toting him about was a pain. Dudley, a creative director in Virginia, couldn't believe that on her rare, precious days off, she was doing what she always did, running around. Eventually, she made a simple but major decision. She quit the holidays. And now, when she texts friends around this time of year, asking how they're holding up, she remembers why she made this choice. It's like sad emoji, crying emoji, she told me. You know, mom's fighting with so-and-so. It's chaos. Meanwhile, she's curled up on the couch, dog in her lap, watching junky TV. Hypothetically, any adult in the year 2024 can do the same. They can decline party invites and hunker down for a movie marathon, or book a solo trip to Oslo, or just put in a normal day's work and stash the calendar in a drawer. They might have a serious reason for doing so. Maybe they're queer and their relatives don't accept it, and they're trying to stay sober and the drinks will be flowing from 3 p.m. on. But the motivation to skip could also be more mundane. For many people, it's all of the expectations, traveling, bringing gifts, cooking an elaborate meal, putting on a constant cheery face. They'd rather just have some peace. The problem is that opting out involves ditching those who are dutifully observing, probably people you care about on some level, people you might not get to see very often or at any point outside this event. What one person calls honoring boundaries could sound selfish to another. The point of holidays, arguably, isn't just to enjoy them, it's to connect with loved ones, even if that process can be onerous. I spoke with ethicists, an etiquette expert, and a few holiday quitters about whether such a resignation is warranted, and I came away thinking that perhaps more people should drop out of the holidays, or at least spend them how they want to. But that means they have a responsibility to create new rituals, ones that they and their family can all enjoy. About 15 years ago, Christine Conway, a leadership development coach in Texas, had a realization. Christmas wasn't fun. She has three siblings who all have children, and the whole gang, with all of the in-laws, all of the kids, would get together at her mom's house. She was buying gifts for 20 to 30 people, and given that she didn't know many of them all that well, she feared that some of her purchases would end up in a garage sale, she told me. It felt like the same group conversations happened each time. Everyone seemed to be following a script, but it wasn't clear that it was one that anyone wanted to follow. When Conway and Dudley told their respective families that they weren't coming to their annual gatherings, they began a tradition of almost comically low-key holidays. Dudley started using Thanksgiving for all of the things she wanted to do but couldn't during her busy weeks. Sleeping in, listening to a good playlist, having a cozy, easy dinner with her husband and son. This year they ordered from Cracker Barrel. Conway spent her extra free time on chores, organizing CDs, or cleaning out computer files. But deciding to take a chill solo holiday can have consequences, including hurting the people who are attending. For years, Dudley and Conway both had relatives calling, trying to understand their absence. Dudley says hers were always asking, "Why aren't they here? Do they not like us? Are they mad?" Family relationships, as much as we like to think of them as unconditional, do need to be nurtured. Damage to them isn't always easy to repair. However annoyed you get around the holidays, that damage might matter not just to others, but also to you. Family members can give you particular rewards that others might not. Perhaps they've watched you grow up, and without them you'd lose a connection to your past self. Or maybe they know what it's like to come from your clan, and because of that, the world feels a little less lonely. Simon Keller, a philosopher at the Victoria University of Wellington in New Zealand, told me that people often talk about familial obligations. For instance, about what you owe your parents, given that they took care of you when you were young. But he prefers to think instead about benefits. Perhaps the choice, he told me, is not between doing what's right for you and what's right for your family, but rather what's right for you in the short term, avoiding stress, and what's right for you in the long term, nurturing relationships that, however difficult, are still meaningful. The time we have to enjoy these benefits is limited. Dudley was reminded of this when a couple of years ago her husband's father died. He was one of the people for whom it had been so important to have everyone together. And yet, the holidays aren't the only opportunities to connect with kin. Putting too much pressure on one special occasion is part of what makes it stressful in the first place. If anything, the holiday quitters I spoke with had been pushed to find more thoughtful, more intimate ways to spend time with family, doing activities that they actually all enjoyed, sharing quieter moments one-on-one or in smaller groups. When Conway dropped out, she also started taking loved ones on special little trips sometime around, but not and, at Christmas. She didn't feel so guilty about being a no-show to the big group affairs, given that she'd already taken her parents to see the Nutcracker at the Base Performance Hall in Fort Worth, or treated them to a nice dinner. Her parents have both died since, and she still looks at the pictures from those times. I'm just really glad we did that, she told me. She decided to continue the tradition with her daughter. They started going on vacation in December. One year they went on a yoga retreat and wore Christmas hats on the beach. Dudley also told me that getting together because you want to hang out, not because it's a federally recognized occasion, can have more weight to it. That can still involve creating rituals. She and her brother, for instance, always get together the Sunday after Thanksgiving to play video games. Their mom loves watching them enjoy what they loved as kids. And after Dudley's father-in-law died, she and her husband started making a point to show up for her mother-in-law, especially around the holidays, knowing that she was feeling her husband's absence acutely. But they liked to just grab pizza, chat, watch a TV show, nothing fancy. "I want you to know that I care about you on a Wednesday," Dudley said, "not just because it's Thanksgiving." Attending a less-than-thrilling shindig, anyway, isn't necessarily a noble sacrifice. Some people might stick to stressful holiday plans, not just out of care for their family, but because passively going along with traditions might be easier than challenging them. Samantha Brennan, a philosopher at the University of Gulf, told me, "They grumpily show up as if they have no say, are present without really being present, and then feel that they've done their part until the next holiday." But growing up means taking some responsibility for your part in shaping family relationships. You don't just get to go back to being a kid in the family where the parents tell you what to do and then you complain about it, she said. You're an adult, and you negotiate with your parents the same way you negotiate with other adults. Inevitably, families change over time, and their routines change with them. Kids get older, spouses get divorced, people die. The ones left start finding partners, or having children, or bringing along new friends. Everyone's interests and priorities evolve. The task, as that happens, Brennan thinks, is to craft something that suits the needs of the people who are there now, as they are now. That might mean going to the family gathering after all, but bucking some of the supposed expectations. If staying the full length of an event sounds intense, leave early, Lisa Groats, an etiquette expert and consultant, told me. If you don't have time to cook, buy something ready-made. This way you can exercise some agency while still showing up. And your attendance could mean a lot, Brennan pointed out, to guests who might be struggling even more than you are. She lives in a queer community, and some of her friends, she told me, show up to their family's holiday parties, even though homophobic relatives attend. One of the kids at these gatherings might turn out to be gay, Brennan's friends tell her, and they want that young person to know that they're not the only one. If you simply don't want to be there for the main family event, though, it's okay to opt out entirely. Just make sure, Groats said, that you always notify the hosts as early as possible. Give a brief explanation. She suggested, "I've had a lot going on and need some time to recharge. Thank you for thinking of me." And offer an alternative way to connect. A phone chat, a smaller get-together, whatever you can manage. You might be surprised to find that your family is understanding, or even relieved, if you've given them permission to do what they really want to do. In all likelihood, you weren't the only one stressing. Dudley and Conway both told me that after the requisite grumbling about cancellations, other guests started dropping out of their family's standard mega gatherings, branching off into smaller celebrations that they seem to really love. That's the thing about thinking of kinship in terms of benefits rather than obligations, Keller told me. The framework helps you consider not what you're supposed to do, but what everyone involved could gain. Maybe that means being together on the actual holiday or some other time. Maybe it means an elaborate festivity or a low-maintenance one. Whatever your plan is, if you approach it with intention, the result can be like your family itself. Imperfect, particular, and totally worthwhile. That completes the article. The title was "What If You Just Skipped the Holidays?" by Atlantic staff writer Faith Hill. This next article is from the technology section of the magazine. Has your cat closed its rings today? Welcome to the era of the quantified pet, by Kristen Brown. One dreary November Monday, as I was enjoying a morning cup of tea, my phone alerted me that my cat, Avalanche, was exercising less than usual. For the past 6 weeks, Avalanche has worn a sleek black and gold collar that tracks her every move, when and how often she sleeps, runs, walks, eats, drinks, and even grooms. This notification told me that her energy was lower than typical, so I should keep an eye on her food and water intake. As a veteran hypochondriac, I wondered for a second whether this might be the first sign of some horrible and serious condition. Then I opened the Smart Collar app, where I found reassurance. My lazy 7-year-old tabby had exercised for just 45 seconds so far that morning, compared with 1 whole minute the day before. These days, Americans treat our furry pals like members of the family, shelling out for premium food and expensive drugs to keep them healthier longer. There are pet treadmills and supplements and luxury spas. The U.S. pet market is poised to reach about $200 billion in sales by the end of the decade. At the same time, humans have become accustomed to a life that's ever more quantified, with watches and phones that passively track heart rate and steps. Gadgets such as continuous glucose monitors are available to those who seek even more detail. Of course, we'd entered the era of the quantified pet, tracking our four-legged companions' diet, sleep, and exercise, just as we do for ourselves. The promise of this tech is a healthier pet. Animals can't communicate in words when they're feeling poorly, but data, the thinking goes, could reveal behavioral or medical issues early and make them easier to treat. But a deluge of data can make real health concerns difficult to discern. It also totally stressed me out. Most pet owners probably wonder what their animals get up to when the humans are away. Are they running around the house, rummaging through the cupboard for greenies? Avalanche and her kid brother, Louie, stole a bag of treats out of a basket while I was on vacation a few years ago. Avalanche's smart collar, called Catlog, gave me insight into some of her secret behaviors. She often has a drink and a snack after I've gone to bed, before settling in for the night herself. She frequently sleeps the entire time I am at the office. Other information was less useful. Avalanche drinks water an average of 4 times a day, eats 5 or so times, exercises about 2 minutes, and spends about 30 minutes grooming, which the Catlog app informs me is somewhat low compared with similar cats. My Apple Watch can't even tell me how often I eat and groom. Most of what she does really is sleep. I could have told you that without a kitty Apple Watch. And yet, most days since I downloaded the app, at least one notification has popped up flagging changes in Avalanche's activity, eating more, exercising less, or just generally seeming less energetic. And I had no clue whether any of it was important. After a few weeks, I found myself inclined to ignore the notifications altogether. My experience may seem to be a common one. Elena Horisky Douglas, a pet tech expert at the University of Glasgow, told me she stopped checking data from her own dog's tracking collar. "I just kept getting notifications of how much she had walked," she said. "I found it quite hard to know what that information meant. It's a problem across the industry," David Roberts, who studies animal-computer interaction at North Carolina State University, told me. None of these systems have yet cracked the code of how to take what they're able to measure and derive the kinds of insights that owners want. The pet wearables market is expected to about double by the end of the decade, and as it expands, it has the opportunity to offer some pet owners genuinely useful information. Jennifer Weiler, a nurse who lives in Brooklyn with 7 cats, each of which wears a smart collar from a company called Mogi told me she takes comfort in the app when she's working long shifts. It's kind of just peace of mind to be able to check in, make sure they're still, you know, getting playtime, she said. Roberts studies how to use computers to train and evaluate dogs that are candidates to become service dogs. AI combined with sensors, for example, can look for signs of stress and other indicators. He told me the story of a colleague whose dog was a beta tester for one such wearable device. The technology had consistently predicted that her dog would be a good service dog, until one day it didn't. It turned out the dog had a bad staph infection, which can become serious if left untreated. Wearables could be especially helpful for cats, who are notoriously cryptic and tend to hide pain until a condition has significantly progressed. My first cat died mysteriously at age 7, her white blood cell count dangerously elevated just 2 days after I noticed that she had become lethargic and was yowling in distress. Perhaps I could have gotten her better treatment if a wearable had alerted me sooner, and crucially, if I had identified the warning signal among the endless noise of notifications. A spokesperson for Raybo, the Japanese company that makes Catlog, wouldn't share the criteria its AI uses to trigger alerts. The alerts are designed to detect significant changes in your cat's behavior or health data to help you take action when needed, she said. The company also sells a litter box mat that monitors weight and bathroom use. A product video assures users that it will prevent all these data from becoming overwhelming. But I got heaps of information from Catlog, and so far none of it has helped me identify actual problems. When I took Avalanche in for her annual exam, I asked the vet about some of the things Catlog had flagged. According to the app, Avalanche ate and drank and ran around less than other cats, and I wondered if she was depressed or sick. My vet waved me off with a look that read somewhere between bemusement and, "Are you out of your mind?" The excessive notifications may have been a ploy for my engagement as much as they were attempts to alert me about my cat's behavior. I assume that these notifications are just, "We want eyeballs on our app," Roberts told me. Research has shown that many pet wearables capture an alarming amount of data about people, not just their pets. One study found that some pet tech apps captured data such as owners' addresses and when they were home. Catlog's privacy policy notes that it may track information about users' online activity and share it with third parties. A company spokesperson told me that the primary goal of collecting data from human users is to ensure that the app and devices provide maximum value to cat parents, and that the company's privacy policy is a broad statement designed to account for potential future uses, which is not necessarily representative of information the app currently collects. Hersky Douglas said that wearables companies could also share the information they collect with, say, pet insurers, just as some auto insurers track your driving habits and life insurers might track your health. She also mentioned people have used trackers to spy on their dog sitters and make sure they are actually walking the dog. And Catlog is far from the only product competing for pet owners' attention. Mogi offers an AI chatbot that impersonates users' cats and answers health questions from their perspective. There are countless options for dogs. Sometimes when I'm at work or on the subway, I absent-mindedly open the catalog app to find, for example, that Avalanche recently ran for 3 seconds and then proceeded to take a 32-minute nap. It feels like the equivalent of texting my bestie or scrolling her Instagram feed, just because she's on my mind. Spying on my cat has been fun, but not fun enough to justify the anxiety it induces. My husband, who is not a hypochondriac, didn't find the app all that stressful, but didn't find it useful either. The day before I wrote this story, the caller's battery died. I haven't bothered to recharge it yet. That's the end of the article. The title was "Has Your Cat Closed Its Rings Today?" by Atlantic staff writer Kristen Brown. I'm going to take a moment to remind those of you that may have tuned in late, this is the Atlantic Magazine program brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer reader. I'm reading from the online edition of the Atlantic. All of the articles were published in December of 2024. I'll continue the program with this article from the politics section. Maybe Democrats didn't do so badly after all. The party's debate about reinventing itself after the election has gotten more complicated, by Russell Berman. 5 weeks after last month's election, Senator Chris Murphy rendered a damning verdict on his party's performance. "That was a cataclysm," the Connecticut Democrat wrote on X. "Electoral map wipeout. Donald Trump had won both the popular vote and the biggest electoral college victory, 312 to 226, for any Republican since 1988. Democrats had lost their Senate majority and appeared unlikely to retake the House. The Democratic Party had lost touch with far too many American voters," Murphy concluded. "We are beyond small fixes." Other prominent Democrats saw a similarly sweeping repudiation of the party's brand. It should come as no great surprise that a Democratic Party, which has abandoned working-class people, would find that the working class has abandoned them, Senator Bernie Sanders wrote in a statement issued less than 24 hours after the polls closed. At the time of those reactions, millions of voters had yet to be counted, and several of the nation's closest House races remained uncalled. Now a clearer picture of the election has emerged, complicating the debate over whether Democrats need to reinvent themselves and whether voters really abandon them at all. Trump's popular vote margin has shrunk to about 1.5%, one of the tightest in the past half century. And because some votes went to third-party and independent candidates, he'll fall just short of winning a majority of the vote nationwide. Compared with incumbent governments elsewhere in the world, Democrats' losses were modest. And in the House, they gained a seat, leaving the GOP with the second-smallest majority in history. A trio of Republican vacancies expected early next year will make passing Trump's agenda even more difficult, and Democrats are in a strong position to recapture the chamber in the midterm elections, when the incumbent party typically struggles. The final results are prompting some in the party to push back against the doom and gloom diagnoses of Murphy, Sanders, and others who say the Democratic brand is in tatters and needs an overhaul. If the Democratic brand was fundamentally broken and needed to be thrown out, this election would have been a complete blowout. And it was not. It was way too close. Yasmin Radji, the executive director of Swing Left, a Democratic organizing group, told me. Another Democrat who requested anonymity In order to speak candidly, put it this way. We lost an election. We didn't lose the country. In some areas, the election looked like a red wave. Compared with 4 years ago, the presidential vote swung to the right by about 10 points in some of the most populous blue states, such as New York, California, and New Jersey. But down-ballot races offer a solid case for Democratic optimism. The party label appeared to be far less of an albatross for Democratic congressional candidates than it was in strong Republican years, such as 2010 and 2014. In the Senate this year, although Republicans flipped 4 seats, Democratic candidates prevailed in 4 battleground states that Kamala Harris lost to Trump. And according to the Cook Political Report's David Wasserman, Democrats could have retaken the House majority with only 7,309 more votes across 3 congressional districts. Democrats also held their own in state legislative races. They made gains in Wisconsin and broke a Republican supermajority in North Carolina, although they lost ground elsewhere. Overall, the party retained significantly more power in state capitals than it did when Trump first took office in 2017. There could have been a red wave in the states, and there wasn't. Heather Williams, the president of the Democratic Legislative Campaign Committee, told me, "I genuinely see this election as defying odds." The Democrats I spoke with over the past week were cautious in defending their party's down-ballot performance, lest they be accused of minimizing Harris's loss to a convicted felon in a race many of them had characterized as an existential referendum on American democracy. The stakes were so high that even getting it wrong by a few points is cataclysmic, Radji acknowledged, and the implications for our country, for our democracy, for people's lives, are really serious. The party's House gains were enough to earn Representative Susan DelBene of Washington State a second term as chair of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee. But she was careful not to declare any sort of victory. "We did a lot of things right," DelBene told me, "but we want to be in the majority, and there's more that we can do." After seeing the full results, Murphy told me that he still considered the election a cataclysm for Democrats. His alarm stems from the party's deepening losses among working-class voters, long the backbone of the Democratic Party. That trend continued this year, and the party also lost significant ground with non-white voters in major cities. Murphy contends that the Democratic coalition has shrunk to the point where the party simply isn't competitive in enough places to win a majority. "The outlook is particularly grim in the Senate," he said, "where Democrats no longer hold any seats in a solidly red state, thanks to losses in Montana, West Virginia, and Ohio. Morally and intellectually, how do you continue as the party of the working class and poor when every single election, fewer of them are voting for you?" Murphy told me. "There becomes a real dishonesty and inauthenticity within our party if we look at this last election as too close to call or good spots and bad spots." Murphy believes that Democrats should respond by embracing economic populism and welcoming people who have conservative views on cultural issues such as guns, immigration, and the environment. Some of the party's successes from last month agree with him. Representative Pat Ryan won a competitive re-election bid in New York's Hudson Valley by 14 points, outperforming Harris by double digits. He attributed his victory to both focusing on the affordability crisis in his district and breaking with Democrats on issues such as the border. The Democratic brand has become toxic, Ryan told me. I certainly felt a pretty resounding message from voters that in many places and with many candidates, we're just out of touch and in a bubble and not connected to the daily pressure, pain, struggle, challenges that the majority of people are facing. Not all Democrats who won tough races did so by criticizing their party. Kristen McDonnell Rivett, a Michigan Democrat who outperformed Harris by 9 points, said voters in her Trump-supporting district seem to hate both parties equally. They are sick of politics, McDonnell Rivett told me. If this election was supposed to be a message to the Democratic Party, I would have lost, she said. The party is still combing through election data in search of clues as to why its candidates perform better down the ballot than at the top of the ticket, and in certain places more than others. The answers will likely determine whether the reboot that Murphy and Ryan are advocating gains momentum. We should not jump to conclusions, Ridgey says. However devastating last month's defeat was for Democrats, they did not fall as far from power as many first thought. And that's the end of the article. The title was Maybe Democrats Didn't Do So Badly After All, by Atlantic staff writer Russell Berman. The title of the next article is How to Navigate the Era of Trump, Advice from the Friends Who Sit on My Bookshelves, by Elliot Cohen. Many friends of mine are pretty deep in the slough of despond. I occasionally plead with them to make their predictions of catastrophe less hopeless and categorical, but with less success than I wish. I respect their points of view, but have decided to look elsewhere for advice, and so have turned to a different set of friends, those sitting on my bookshelves. Some of these friends have been with me for more than half a century, and they get wiser and more insightful with age. One of the first I turn to is only slightly older than I am, Motivation and Personality, by the academic psychologist Abraham Maslow. The book has a family history. Maslow summered at a lake in Maine in a cabin near one owned by my grandfather, a self-made shoe factory owner who came to the United States with only the benefit of a grade school education. The story goes that Maslow was complaining about his inability to finish writing his magnum opus while surrounded by the clamor of kids and holiday makers. After a couple of days of this, Sam Cohen turned to him, told him that writing was a job like any other, and that he had set aside an office for him in his factory. And then he ordered, rather than invited him, to go there and finish the book. Maslow did, and I have the author's inscription on the title page to prove it. Maslow thought that psychology had focused excessively on the pathological. He was interested instead in what made for psychological health, a deeper and truer objective, to my mind, than the contemporary quest for happiness, which tends to be ephemeral and occasionally inappropriate to our circumstances. Here are two relevant bits. Quote, since for healthy people, the unknown is not frightening, they do not have to spend any time laying the ghost, whistling past the cemetery, or otherwise protecting themselves against imagined dangers. They do not neglect the unknown or deny it, or run away from it, or try to make believe it is really known, nor do they organize, dichotomize, or rubricize it prematurely. End quote. And then this, quote, They can take the frailties and sins, weaknesses, and evils of human nature in the same unquestioning spirit with which one accepts the characteristics of nature. One does not complain about water because it is wet, or about rocks because they are hard, or about trees because they are green. As the child looks out upon the world with wide, uncritical, undemanding, innocent eyes, simply noting and observing what is the case, without either arguing the matter or demanding that it be otherwise, so does the self-actualizing person tend to look upon human nature in himself and others. End quote. This is, as Maslow says, the Stoic style, and one to which a person should aspire in a world where norms are flouted, wild things are done, and wilder said, and perils, real and imagined, loom before us. Maslow's healthy individual has little inclination to spluttering outrage, which does not mean ignoring unpleasant realities. Just the reverse, in fact. Having settled into that frame of mind, what about the matter of predicting Trump administration policies? Another even older friend, George Orwell, speaks to that one. Quote, political predictions are usually wrong, but even when one makes a correct one, to discover why one was right can be very illuminating. In general, one is only right when either wish or fear coincides with reality. End quote. This, I suspect, is going to be a particular problem in dealing with the world of Donald Trump. Neither widely shared hopes that he will ignore Tucker Carlson and Donald Trump Jr., for example, and be more or less normal in most respects, nor fears that he's going to do whatever he wants and be even crazier than he lets on, will be useful guides. But being human, we will make judgments constantly distorted by both emotions. Orwell has a solution. Quote, to see what is in front of one's nose needs a constant struggle. One thing that helps toward it is to keep a diary, or at any rate to keep some kind of record of one's opinions about important events. Otherwise, when one particularly absurd belief is exploded by events, one may simply forget that one ever held it. End quote. Useful advice from a man who confessed that most of his own predictions during World War II were wrong, although, as I know from experience, his remedy can be a painful corrective. On what basis, then, should one attempt to predict Trumpian policy? A downright ancient friend comes to the rescue on this one. Quote, begin the morning by saying to thyself, I shall meet with the busybody, the ungrateful, arrogant, deceitful, envious, unsocial. End quote. This from Marcus Aurelius, the last good Roman emperor and a thoughtful Stoic philosopher, is not a bad beginning in looking at an administration that will have a few barbarians in it. He continues, quote, whatever man you meet, say to yourself at once, what are the principles this man entertains about human goods and ills? For if he has certain principles about pleasure and pain and the sources of these, about honor and dishonor, about death and life, it will not seem surprising or strange to me if he acts in certain ways. End quote. So much of the contemporary speculation about the administration depends on the distinctive personality of the president-elect and some of his more outre advisors and confidants. But simply ranting about them does not help one understand what is going on. One of the troubles with the anti-Trump camp is the tendency simply to demonize. Some demonic characters may roam about the administration, but we would be better off trying to figure out what makes Trump tick. In particular, that phrase about honor and dishonor is worth pondering. For a man in his eighth decade, with remarkable political success to his credit, who has just survived two assassination attempts, honor, in Marcus Aurelius's sense, is probably something beyond owning the libs. More likely, Trump is looking to record enduring accomplishments, including a peace deal in Ukraine. Figuring out what he would like those to be, and in what way, is probably the best method of figuring out how to influence him, to the extent that anyone can. Let us say that we get better at training our judgments and anticipating what the administration will do and why. There may still be plenty of things to brood about, the possibilities of tariff wars, betrayals of allies, mass deportations, attempts to prosecute deep state denizens, and more. Even if Trump himself may be considerably less destructive than some fear, the MAGA movement will be out there, acolytes looking for opportunities to exit NATO, ban abortion entirely, make getting vaccines through Medicare impossible, sabotage the institutions that guarantee free and fair elections, or simply grift and corrupt their way through ambassadorships and other high government offices. For that, something more spiritual is indicated, and I find it in the Library of America edition of one of the previous century's deep thinkers, Reinhold Niebuhr. Quote, God, give us grace to accept with serenity the things that cannot be changed, courage to change the things that should be changed, and the wisdom to distinguish the one from the other. End quote. Serenity will be something we will need in the years ahead. If you ask me, a well-stocked library will be of more help getting there than tranquilizers, wide-eyed staring at one's mobile phone, or scrambling to find out if an Irish ancestor qualifies you for a European Union passport. That's the end of the article. The author, Elliot Cohen, is a contributing writer at The Atlantic. He is a professor emeritus at Johns Hopkins University and the author of The Hollow Crown, Shakespeare on How Leaders Rise, Rule, and Fall. His article was titled, How to Navigate the Era of Trump. The title of this article is Silicon Valley Heads to Mar-a-Lago. The tech industry's Trump taboo is quickly becoming a distant memory, by Laura Kelly. The days of tech CEOs tussling with Donald Trump are fading. After distancing themselves from Trump during his first administration and publicly rebuking him after the events of January 6, 2021, many Silicon Valley leaders are now taking a softer approach. Jeff Bezos, Mark Zuckerberg, and OpenAI CEO Sam Altman have each pledged, through their companies or their personal coffers, individual $1 million donations to Trump's inauguration fund. The Google co-founder, Sergey Brin, who protested Trump's immigration policies in 2017, apparently dined at Mar-a-Lago with Trump and Google's CEO Sundar Pichai this month. Bezos, along with the heads of TikTok and Netflix, are reportedly on the schedule there this week, too. As Trump put in a press conference today, In the first term, everybody was fighting me. In this term, everybody wants to be my friend. Friendship may not be exactly what these tech CEOs are after. Self-preservation seems to be playing a role. These companies don't want to lose out on government contracts or face retribution from a man known for threatening to punish his critics. For years, Trump was no friend to tech, and vice versa. During his first term, he used Twitter to lob insults at Amazon and its then CEO Bezos. And as recently as this past summer, Trump was hurling unfounded accusations at Zuckerberg. Ambition is likely part of the calculus, too. CEOs hope that Trump will go easier on the industry than the Biden administration did, including on crypto and AI. Now, as Trump prepares to take office a second time, tech executives seem eager to please the president-elect and to start a new chapter in their relationship that elides the past. Throughout Trump's 2024 campaign, tech executives were privately speaking with Trump about their interests and policy preferences. After the election, the public congratulations quickly rolled in. Business leaders attempting to get on good terms with an incoming administration is not unheard of. But the machinations here are happening out in the open. As my colleague Ali Breland wrote last week, until recently, elites and politicians who worked together feared the scandal of the sausage-making process being revealed and the public backlash that could come with it. Now, with Elon Musk setting a new standard for blatantly self-serving political participation, including attempts to influence the outcome of an election, his peers are operating more brazenly than they once did. Beyond the tech CEOs who are donating to and hobnobbing with Trump, several prominent venture capitalists who stump for Trump are now advocating for their fellow tech leaders to be nominated for roles in the Trump administration. The venture capitalist David Sachs, an outspoken Trump supporter, has been named the AI and crypto czar for the incoming administration. And of course, the vice president-elect was once a venture capitalist too. Donating to any president-elect's inauguration fund is a standard way for corporations to signal goodwill. Some tech companies, including Google and Amazon, quietly gave relatively small amounts to Trump's first inauguration fund, according to data published by Open Secrets. Firms such as Google and Microsoft donated to President Joe Biden's inauguration fund, and a seven-figure tech donation is not unprecedented. Microsoft gave more than $2 million to President Barack Obama for his 2013 inauguration. The flow of such large sums from multiple executives this year, Margaret O'Mara, a historian of Silicon Valley, told me in an email, is both a reflection of the growth of inaugural spending generally and the surging profits and net worth of tech's biggest names. And the meetings with and warm statements from tech leaders who are donating this money signals a new chapter of cooperation between big tech and Trump. The tech industry has always relied to an extent on the federal government, but its political allegiances have shifted. A free market libertarian strain has long run through the region and industry, though in the 2010s the industry cozied up to the Obama administration, a relationship that benefited both sides. During the first Trump term, the government-tech relationship became uneasy. Social platforms attempted damage control after blowback from employees and users who blamed them for Trump's ascent to office. Remember Zuckerberg's national listening tour in 2017? As Trump enters his second term, having received close to half of the country's vote, support for him may not risk that same level of public outrage. In many circles, the Trump taboo is over. As Omara put it, the social consequences of supporting Trump are lesser, and the business risks of crossing him are higher. When Zuckerberg visited Mar-a-Lago on the evening before Thanksgiving, he and other guests reportedly stood with hands over hearts while listening to a recording of the national anthem sung by people accused of January 6th related crimes. Whether Zuckerberg knew who the singers were is unclear, but the scene was uncanny given that January 6th, when it happened, was a bright red line for the tech industry. Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Twitch banned or suspended Trump, and companies such as Amazon paused donations to election deniers. Now, with the arrival of Trump 2.0, that red line has been erased entirely. That completes the article, Silicon Valley Heads to Mar-a-Lago, by Laura Kelly. And that also completes the program today. This has been the Atlantic Magazine program, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. It's been my privilege to be your reader. The articles I read today were from the online edition of the Atlantic Magazine, all published in December of 2024. I hope you enjoyed the program, and I hope you found it informative. Stay well, stay safe, have a wonderful week. Keep listening to the premium programming of Sun Sounds of Arizona. And if you missed a program you'd like to hear, go to the sunsounds.org website, click on the broadcast info and audio, then click on the word demand. You'll see a list of programs available to you. Hopefully the one you're looking for is on that list. Thank you so much for spending your time with me today.